हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रीअद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासरि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 58, Chapter 27, Canto 10. The atheistic Shankyite philosophers will, of course, offer their arguments that the material cosmic manifestation is due to Prakriti and Purusha, material nature and the living entity, or the material cause and the effective cause. But Krishna is the cause of all causes. He is cause of both the material and effective causes. Prakriti and Purusha are not the ultimate cause. Superficially, it appears that a child is born due to the combination of the father and mother. But the ultimate cause of both the father and mother is Krishna. He is therefore the original cause, or the cause of all causes, as confirmed in the Brahma Samhita. Both the Supreme Lord and the living entities enter into the material nature. The Supreme Lord Krishna, by one of his plenary expansions, manifests as Karanadakshai, Mahavishnu, the gigantic Vishnu form lying in the causal ocean. Then, from that gigantic form of Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu expands and enters into every universe. From him, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva expand. Vishnu, as Kirudakshaya Vishnu, enters into the hearts of all living entities, as well as into all material elements, including the atom. The Brahma Samhita says, Andanta Rasta Paramanu Chayanta Rastam. The Lord is within this universe and also within every atom. Right? So you always have to be able to take it back, because there may be the immediate that you see, but the point is that doesn't mean that that is the ultimate point, because we're discussing philosophy. Right? So in philosophy, then you have to bring out the aspects of that it's coming from Krishna. The living entity has a small material body taken in various species and forms. And similarly, the whole universe is but the material body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This body is described in the Shastras as Virat Rup. As the individual living entity leaves the material body, the body is immediately annihilated. And similarly, as soon as Lord Vishnu leaves this cosmic manifestation, everything is annihilated. Therefore, only when the living entity surrenders under the Supreme Personality of Godhead is his liberation from material existence possible. Right? So, because it's the, we leave the body, but then we take another one. He leaves it, then that aspect is destroyed. So only if you take shelter of him, then you can be beyond this cycle of birth and death. Right? Because he's the one that controls it. And he's always transcendentally situated. So then if one attains the Lord, one attains that transcendental position. Right? This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Mam eva ye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. Bhagavad Gita 7:14. Surrendering unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead and nothing else is therefore the cause of liberation. How the living entity becomes liberated from the modes of material nature after surrendering unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead is illustrated by the example of a sleeping man within a room. When a man is sleeping, everyone sees that he is present within the room. But actually, the man himself is not within that body. For while sleeping, a man forgets his bodily existence, although others may see that his body is present. Similarly, a liberated person engaged in devotional service to the Lord may be seen by others to be engaged in household duties of the material world. But since his consciousness is fixed in Krishna, he does not live within this world. His engagements are different. exactly as the sleeping man's engagements are different from his bodily engagements, right? Because in the dream, so many things are going on, right? It is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita that a devotee engaged full-time in the transcendental loving service of the Lord has already surpassed the influence of the three modes of material nature. He is already situated on the Brahman platform and is in the transcendental realm, although he appears to be living within the body or within the material world. Right? That's important because one has to know which perspective you're looking at. Right? So that's the point. He's transcendentally situated, but it appears he's here. Just as a sleeping man appears he's there, but technically he's not. Because he's not bodily conscious. He's not aware of these things. So in the same way as the transcendentally situated person may be functioning within the body, but the body itself is not seen as something separate. It's only seen as activity, to be engaged in Krishna's service. Right?
So Maharaj, is it the reason why we need to consider the body of the spiritual master as spiritual?
Yes, yes, that's all. Because the engagement in Krishna's service. So when we're engaged, then it takes on that quality. Because we have to remember, it's Krishna's energy. He does with it as he pleases. So if every one of his limbs can do what anything else does, so as he likes to engage his energies, then they can accomplish his task. He's set his sankalpa. He's not going to desire something that can't happen. Right? It just doesn't work. We do, but he doesn't. So therefore, is that one can function within this world, but at the same time, you're not here. It's just like, another example that Prabhupada's given in other places, it's like the warden in the prison. The warden moves freely through the prison, though he's in the prison. He may go into a cell, but he's not controlled by that cell. He's not controlled by the prison. He follows the rules. He doesn't walk through the walls and stuff. He goes through the pathways and up the stairs and down and all these different things. But he's not controlled by it. So even though it appears he's there, he's technically not there. He's part of the free society. While the prisoners, they're part of the prison. But even though they physically seem to be in the same place, but technically they're part of two different existences. So then someone who's engaged in devotional service, in pure devotional service, then they're not in this world. Right? You may see them physically present here, but they're not part of this world. They're part of the spiritual world. Right? These are all part of Krishna's inconceivable potencies. That's how it's working. So we're dealing with something much bigger than what our intelligence, what our senses are perceiving. That's why when this Shastra says all these things, then that we have to take seriously. We can't say, well, how is this happening? It's just like I have a piece of iron. And this piece of iron is sitting there. And I know this piece of iron. It's been sitting here for a long time. And then simply by taking it and putting it into this fire here, then someone's saying that it completely is different. How can that be? It's the same old iron. I've known that iron the whole time. In fact, I made them a devotee. How can they this and that? Like this and that. No, point is, it's fire. You can say it's iron, it's this, it's made, well, what's it made out of? And it's made out of, it's made out of the same atoms. But it's fire. So that's the whole thing. When one's in devotional service, one's transcendentally situated. So one isn't here, even though it appears they're here. Yes?
I just wanted to clarify, is this a description of level of bhav or just general description?
It's a general description. Similarly, a liberated person. So it would generally be that platform, yes. But the same time is, if one's taken up devotional service, he's actually in the liberated position. Because he's not, devotional service is not happening on the material platform, it's happening on the spiritual platform. So that means technically all devotees are on the liberated platform. It's just a matter of whether they realize that or not. Does that make sense? So that's why you have the specifics of dealing with devotees. Like, can you offend any devotee? Means, does it say only Uttamadikaris you can't offend? Be a little careful with the Madhyamas, but you know, a mistake here and there's not. But the neophytes, hey, go for it. No, it's just devotees. Right? And then, if they're a Madhyama, then their reaction is even greater. And if they're an Uttama, it's even greater. But their reaction is devotees, not Uttama. We'll try to define it as, no, it's the Uttama, and I can do whatever I want everybody else. You know, because this is wrong, and they're this and that, so they're not really devotees. And we have all kinds of, you know, just like the Shankyites and all these. They just have tons of philosophy they just keep going with. But in reality, they're liberated. That's why you have to deal differently. That's why etiquette is there. And that etiquette works for all living entities. Because all living entities, technically part and parcel of Krishna, they're all liberated. But they identify in the conditioned state. So that's how it functions. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like an adult. Let's say the kid walks into the room, you know, with something on their head and a sword, like that. So, who are they? Right? You know, they're a king or something, you know, a warrior. So how do you deal with them? As a warrior. You know? That's how you deal. Because if you just say, oh, now that's just how you deal. So etiquette works both ways. Right? It's the same etiquette used in the spiritual world. You apply it here in the material world. It works like a charm. But the local etiquettes, though they are some refinement in some aspect, they're specifically for the local. And outside of the local, they don't actually apply. Right? You know, you'd have to be educated. Like, I don't know, it's like you see so many times when you're walking down the gangway into the airplane, these international flights, and they always have these, there's this one bank, I'm not sure what it is, but they're presenting themselves as a very international bank, so they know all the customs, all the things in all these areas. So if you're dealing with their bank and you're working in that area, then they can help you deal in there. You know, just like, you know, for example, let's say most all the cultures that, you meet a husband and wife. You shake the man's hands first, then the woman's. But in Sweden, it's the other way around. You know, little things like that. So all these different places, so they're regional. But the Vedic etiquette works anywhere. Like even Westerners, let's say something's really going bad and they really want it and they're really asking you, please, please, please. Is it not uncommon that they fold their hands? Very common. It's standard. It's just that in India, there's more of that sincere, that surrender, so they do it all the time. And the other ones, you know, you have to really come off your false ego to be able to do that, you know. So,
but at least you know they're sincere.
At that moment, yes. So, like that. So, that's the thing I noticed also, is that all the different nuances and how you deal and all that, like here, the standard ones in India, especially the Bengali ones, that if you go to other parts of the world, adults won't know what you're doing. But every kid will understand. Doesn't matter their back. Small kids. You know, the smaller they are, they understand them. Because they're just natural. So the whole idea is that this Vedic is the culture. That is the universal culture. It can apply everywhere. But therefore, if you follow Vaishnav etiquette, it'll work anywhere. You see, Prabhupada follows Vaishnav etiquette, but even if you're dealing with a materialist, you follow the same etiquette. And it'll work. Well, if you follow the materialistic etiquette, it might work with that person, but another materialistic person in a different culture, it won't work. And using it on devotees, it also then will be very regional. If they came from the region that you're using it, it works. If not, they don't know what you're talking about or what you're dealing or what do they mean. You understand? So that's the point, is that one doesn't have to use something else. So that's why then this higher understanding of how Vaishnavas and their transcendental position and everything like that, you deal with that etiquette, it works for Uttamas, it works for Madhyamas, it works for neophyte, it works for materialists. Like that. But when we start applying our own concept, then that's where the trouble starts. Because all living entities are transcendental. Though conditioned ones are conditioned to not being transcendental. But they're still transcendental. They're not the body. Right? So that's why the Vaishnava etiquette works everywhere. Does that make sense? So it means, I mean, in the way of the moods and dealings and the consideration and not, you know, not being rough, all these kind of things. Like that. It means you might be, you know, instead of coming up and namaste, you shake the guy's hand. That's another thing. But the point is when you're doing it, you have that full attention. You're not looking at your watch. You're not looking at your phone. You know, you're not looking at the phone. Oh, yeah. Okay. You know, that won't work anywhere.
They say now, if you take out one of the efforts, that's the, you know, you respect the person. Because usually you don't take out none of them, and you talk. And then one is okay, but if you take out two, then really respect.
Okay, yeah.
You want.
But yeah. But my principle is that respect is the point. So how different cultures show their respect, you know, that's unique. But the point is the principle, the Vedic is a group of principles. And then they have their natural sattvic form, as we saw. When Krishna wants to interact with the devotees, he creates that aspect of sattva. Because that has all the nice, proper arrangement. That's the natural form. Then you have Rajas, Tamas, then you make some adjustments. Is that what I'm saying? You know, it's like, you know, I got also the hat. I know sometimes you just nod, you know. But before it was that they tipped it, before they took their hat off. And then it was just they touched the hat. Or even, you know, just, you know, or just a little bit. Or, you know, like that. Then they just would just touch it. And then, you know, or that, or some, you know, some kind of thing. But now it's just a nod, you know.
Prabhupada mentions in many places that pure devotee lives with Krishna and Krishna's planet. So that is what, like, explained here, that by the existence that is, he's always serving the Lord, that's why he's living with God.
Yeah, well, he's living with the Lord. Lord's in his heart. So you're not living with the Lord? And the Lord performing his pastimes and interacting, he's not controlled by time and space. See, that's why he can't be controlled by the material world. Material world is time and space. He's not controlled by time and space. He's the source of it. So how can he be controlled by the material world? Okay. In this connection, Srila Rupa Goswami states in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that the person whose only desire is to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead may be situated in any condition in the material world, but he is to be understood as Jivan Mukta. That is to say, he is to be considered liberated while living within the body or the material world. To conclude, so, and why? Because he only desires to serve the Lord. If you only desire to serve the Lord, then what's material? Right? While if you have material desire, then that's from the material world. Material desire has to be fulfilled in the material world. You can't fulfill it in the spiritual world. Right? Demas tried to do that. Didn't work out very good for them. Right? The conclusion, therefore, is that a person fully engaged in Krishna consciousness is a liberated person. Such a person actually has nothing to do with his material body or the material world, right? You're just doing service. It happens to be with the body in the material world, but you have nothing to do with the body and the material world. Okay. Those who are not in Krishna consciousness are called karmis and jnanis, and they hover on the bodily and mental platforms and thus are not liberated. This situation is called Kaivalya Nirasta Yoni. But a person situated on the transcendental platform is freed from the repetition of birth and death. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 4th chapter, quote, "Simply by knowing the transcendental nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, one becomes free from the chains of repeated birth and death. And after quitting his present body, he goes back home, back to Godhead." This is the conclusion of the Vedas. So we say he's with Krishna. Krishna's plan means he's performing activities to please Krishna. Right? But after leaving the body, then he goes to that place. Then he doesn't have the spiritual body. He's not situated in the material realm. He's situated in the spirit. Here, we're in the material realm, seemingly, but you're actually situated in the spiritual. Just as the demons that come into Vrindavan appears they're in the spiritual world, but they're not. They're in the material world. Because sometimes it comes up, oh, you can't have lust or envy or these things in the spiritual world, so the jiva can't fall from the spiritual world, this, that, blah. But the point is if you have those, you're not there anyway. Because the spiritual world is not controlled by time and space. This argument totally is. Right? So they're not there. We take it, no, but they're situated there. But they're not situated there. Material is consciousness. Spiritual is consciousness. So this kind of thing, this is then what is able to tell the difference. Like remember before it said the pure devotee sees differently. When they look at things, they don't see what we see. We see, oh, what are the opportunities for, you know, control and enjoy. They see what are the opportunities to serve Krishna. So it appears that they're looking at the same thing. But how they're seeing it is connected, is Krishna's energy used for Krishna. You know, according to Krishna's direction. While we see it, you know, here's something that I can use how I like to get what I want. So they're two different realms. Like that. They're not, it means, does that make sense? The material world has its specific place, but the point is because it's all Krishna, how is it material? So what makes it material is our consciousness. So the material world is not, it's a material place. It's part of Krishna's energy that also follows Krishna's laws. But it manifests and unmanifests. That's the difference. It's not conscious, but it's all Krishna's energy, so it's spiritual. But we see it separate from Krishna, so our consciousness is material. That's why it's called the material world. So if you see it in connection to Krishna, you're in the spiritual world. Because it's Krishna. It just may be the, you know, how you say, you know, out back, you know, out in the back where you keep all the old junk and stuff like that, but it's still part of the property. Yeah. You know, all those old refrigerators and, you know, broken lawnmowers. Yeah, that's the place.
Need to recycle.
Huh? Yeah, needs to be recycled. Yeah.
Maharaj, this, simply by knowing the transcendental nature, this knowledge.
Yes.
So, it's just the knowledge that one has to also, like, apply it.
If you have to apply. Means you hear, you get knowledge. Having gotten knowledge, then remembering that, then you contemplate it and practice it. Mm-hmm. And then contemplating and practice it, then with time, then you get realization. Right? Because realization comes from Krishna. All of this comes from Krishna, but each stage is by you study nicely and you pay attention and have that desire, then Krishna being pleased, then you learn something. Then you want to use it, then Krishna being pleased, you can. And then by using it regularly, then Krishna being pleased, then you realize. So it's not knowledge. You start with knowledge as the form. Like here. Is it the pot? Right? Means it's all about the pot. In the water in the pot. Okay. It's not that, well, this particular shape, then the water takes that, and the molecules all realign and all that, so therefore then it has this whole esoteric... Is that the whole thing? No. Means this is... it's about water. You know, and by the nature of water, you know, you can put it on the floor, but the problem is if you want to drink it, that's a little difficult. You know, and the ants that are drinking it aren't very happy. So nobody's happy. Right? So you have put it in a pot. But it's not about the pot, it's about the water. So that's why we say, so, this knowing about Krishna, so it's the knowledge. No, it's not. It's about knowing Krishna. Does that make sense? You know, it's water pot, not water pot. Right? Yeah.
But when you say about the material world, you know, that the material world is a place of misery and things like that. At one time, like we as such criticize, and the second time, next moment, we just say that it is the inferior energy of Krishna. Actually, to spiritual being, it's a matter of consciousness.
Right.
So when you say this particular side, does it mean that you just simply want to encourage the practitioners?
Do we want to encourage the practitioner? We always want to encourage the practitioner, but it's still the fact. What makes it, what brings out the temporary and the misery? That is Krishna's energy?
Our desires.
So it's our consciousness that makes it into that. Right? You want something that won't last forever to last forever, then are we going to be happy or miserable? Yeah. But we see it in relation to Krishna, service to Krishna and his service and his associate, name, form, quality, spot. That's eternal. So then where's the misery? They're both there. You say the one because we think this place is Vaikuntha. You're pointing out it's not Vaikuntha. Right? Because we think it is because, you know, we're the supreme, you know, personality of controller and enjoyment ship, and so therefore then we want to do all this, then it's pointed out that it's not the material world is not that. But the point is that if you want to actually be happy, you have to see it in connection to Krishna. Then you see it when Krishna is the center, then you can see it in this proper life. They're both true. It's just a matter of which perspective you're looking at it from. The living entity trying to be the controller and enjoyer, we're always going to mention the downside. But when we're talking about pure devotional service, then yeah, we don't emphasize that because then people, oh, it's the spiritual world, I don't have to worry, I'm fine. But they don't have the realization. But that's the fact. Because otherwise, if they get too grumpy about it, it's not about getting grumpy, it's about being Krishna conscious. This is the conclusion of all the Vedas. Thus, after understanding the prayers offered by the personified Vedas, one should surrender unto the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. Mm-hmm. Conclusion. The Shrutis can describe Krishna because of their devotion. There is no other way. Right? So it's only by devotion that this can be understood. It's just like this. Is a knife good or bad?
How the person uses.
Right. So then why can't it be the spiritual world and be a place of misery? So, how is the knife bad? Are you using it properly or not? And how is the knife good? Are you using it properly or not? So if you're using Krishna's energy properly, then is it the spiritual world or not?
Yes, it is the spiritual world.
Yeah, and if you're using it badly, is it the spiritual world or the material world?
Material world.
So is there a problem?
The problem being that we say about transporting ourselves to that location, you know, from here. That's
because we think in the terms of location. But as pointed out, you change the consciousness, you're already there. Just like you have the ocean of material existence. Can you swim across? How about if you catch onto the dog's tail? No. Okay. Probably don't try catching anyone else's tail because you don't know what it's like. Yeah. So, but it's insurmountable, right? But now when you step onto the boat, you know, of Vedic knowledge that has the captain as the spiritual master and all that, then how big is this material ocean? Right. And so you can step over it. So does that mean you got on the boat and then everybody has to sit here and wait for the boat to get back? The boat's here. So done? Why be attached to the words? We use the word, you know, go back to Godhead. So we take it as location. Why not take the word back as the important element? Or Godhead, it means if we're always seeing everything connected with God, then why what's the problem? Why we're not in the spiritual, why we're not spiritually situated? So we're demanding that the spiritual has to operate under our conditioned perspective of time and space. But it's already pointed out it's beyond that, so why would that be an argument? Lord Chaitanya, in his apricot lila, is performing his pastimes now.
Yes,
right here.
Yes.
So, going back to Godhead, how far do you have to go? Yeah, and how? What's the distance?
It's a matter of consciousness, actually.
No kilometer, kilometer, yojanas, and all that. Right? You understand? It's just consciousness.
Okay, so then is my understanding correct? I just want to confirm that when we say about the material world being also spiritual, you know, it simply means that that which is uppercut transforms into prakat for that particular devotee who is elevated in his consciousness when he achieves. Is it that?
I lost you.
Mm-hmm. I'm saying that when you say that the material world, okay, changes from material world to the spiritual world, okay, so does it mean that now that means the devotee enters the uppercut lila, and that is why it becomes now spiritual for him? He can realize because he's now into the uppercut.
No, not necessarily.
Because
the point is that it's all Krishna's spiritual energy anyway. Whether you see the apricot or not, it's still the spiritual energy. Right? It's Krishna's, it's spiritual. Now you have superior, you have inferior, and you have those guys in the middle. Right? So the point is it's still Krishna's energy. However you want to look at it. That doesn't change. Right? It's not a matter of, is the guy in the room or not? He's asleep. Is he there or not? He's there, but he's not there. So that's the whole point, is if you're in the spirit, you'll see the body, you'll see the place, that'll be the same. But the person is not situated here, they're in the spiritual world. And it's not that he has to be sitting there in the pastimes and all that kind of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like that. Krishna's all-pervading. So how you're not with Krishna. He's the super soul. How you're not with Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as Bhagavan, that's a matter of you're seeing him in that form. He'll reciprocate from that platform. If not, then Brahman and Paramatma. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yes. Prabhupada mentions in conversation that sunshine and darkness exist simultaneously.
That?
Sunshine and darkness,
yes, yes,
exist simultaneously. Where do you turn to? That's what decides.
Yeah.
Turn towards Krishna and spiritual.
Yes. That's why it says antarmukh or bahirmukh. What's the difference? You just turned around. It's like the ostrich sticks its head in the ground. And now nothing exists. Right?
The hunter will come.
Huh?
And the hunter will come.
Yeah, because the ostrich is very big. Their head is actually very small. So that means their brain is very small.
So then
small.
Can we say that Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is a process of turning?
That Vaidhi Bhakti is a process of turning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Though the Lord is beyond the senses and mind, when persons perform bhakti by the mercy generated by bhakti, the person contacts the Lord's personal shakti. And he becomes visible to the eye of undeserving persons. Thus the Shrutis can describe Krishna because of their devotion. There is no other way. Of all Krishna's glories, the most important is his causeless mercy upon the conditioned souls and reclaiming them from the clutches of Maya. Right? Because that's the glory that we can take part in. That he's kind that he'll bring us out of this. But it's when we want to. Otherwise, if you take someone out of this and they're not interested, then it's a problem. Right? Just remember, like the fisherman, he touched Lord Chaitanya, developed love for Krishna. Right? So he's running around like a madman, but he doesn't know what's going on because he wasn't interested in prema. Right? It doesn't say he had a problem after that. It appears he adjusted. But the point was that it's not, you know, yeah. Yeah, so by devotion, you contact the Lord's personal Shakti, his internal potency. Because of that, he becomes visible to those who are undeserving. Right? Undeserving means those who have the materialistic or who are conditioned. So either in his past times, he comes like that, as the deity, as the holy name, all these different things, as the Bhagavatam. To know the transcendental God is a challenge for God himself, because God and his knowledge are both unlimited. As soon as God is cognizant of some of his energies, he perceives that he still has more energies. In this way, both his energies and his knowledge increase. God is undoubtedly omniscient, but the personified Vedas say that even God himself does not know the full extent of his energies. Still, since bhakti controls God, by bhakti alone he can be known by the jiva through the Vedas. Right, so you can't know the unlimited aspect, because even Krishna doesn't know. Right? Means he doesn't know, and then he knows. Like this is how it goes. But we are not unlimited. So through bhakti, then we know our relationship and how to work, function within that. We don't know all of them. Right? Some things. Yeah. By the mercy of the Lord, the jiva can understand the material world as well. When persons renounce the material world as illusory or false without knowing that the material world is the manifestation of the Supreme Lord, their renunciation is of no value. The Vaishnava, because it's Krishna, and they're renouncing it. The point is then you say, oh, then we can keep everything, you know, then no, it's a matter of you see everything connected to Krishna. That's the actual renunciation. The Vaishnavas, however, are free of attachment to this world because although the material world is generally accepted as an object of sense gratification, the Vaishnavas are not in favor of sense gratification and are therefore not attached to material activities. They're not in favor because what does sense gratification mean? It means you and your senses. It doesn't mean Krishna. Of course, mechanically through the Brahman and Paramatma, his modes of nature and all that, then all these things are going on. But the point is it's without Krishna. That's why it's sense gratification. It's just you're engaging the jnana and kriya shaktis, but not to please Krishna. So of course the senses are being engaged. There's some perception there. But the point is it's limited. It won't give satisfaction to the soul. Right? The soul is only satisfied in relationship to Krishna. So when the senses are engaged, connected to Krishna, it's called bhakti, not sense gratification. So the devotees are not interested in sense gratification. Right? Engaging the senses is not a problem. But engaging the senses without Krishna, now that's a problem. The Vaishnava accepts this material world according to the regulative principles of the Vedic injunctions and works without attachment, since the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the original cause of everything. The Vaishnava sees everything in relationship with Krishna, even in this material world. By such advanced knowledge, everything becomes spiritualized. In other words, everything in the material world is already spiritual, but due to our lack of knowledge, we see things as material. That's what we're calling it. The human body or the material world, right? So that's why you can, either way, you can say, no, but I'm not the, but that's how you connect with the world. So the material body is your world. So what you can perceive of through your body, that is your world. What's beyond that, then, is not your world. Right? So the world has so many aspects that you don't know about because they're connected with other bodies. But Krishna knows all bodies, so that's why he's in control of the whole thing. When used for the human body or the material world, when used for sense gratification, is false. But if the human body and the material creation are used for the service of the Supreme Lord, their activities are never false, right? Because you're engaging them in the connection with Sat, so they take on that nature. It is therefore confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita that even slightly using the body and the material world for the service of the Lord can deliver a person from the gravest danger. When properly utilized, neither the superior nor inferior energies emanating from the Supreme Personality of Godhead are false. Right? The false is when you means I don't do something properly, the result I get is false. Because it's not real. It may be there, but it's not real. In that it doesn't work. Right? But it's not that the elements it's made out of don't exist. Does that make sense? Yeah. Let us say I take a sprig of basil. Right? I put it on the table. Then on top of that, I sprinkle some cheese. No, not on the table. The basil's on the table. I'm sprinkling the cheese on the basil. Okay? Then on top of the basil, I'm going to put some pasta. And then on top of the pasta, I'm going to put a plate upside down. And then on top of that, I'm going to put a tablecloth. Or if you really want to have fun, we'll start with the floor, and on top of that, we'll put the table upside down. So is that real or not? Is that going to be a proper meal? Is it real?
No.
It's not. It means as far as the meal goes, is it real? No. But do the elements exist? Yes. Because the person who did that is going to be cleaning them up. He'll figure out they are real. That's the whole point. The material world is real. But how we deal with it, not in connection to Krishna, the result we get is false. So it's temporary. It's not sought. Yeah?
These definitions are absolutely different. What is false and what is real? The material world, that's false, or that is true, you know, like the example that we gave. Uh-huh. It's very deeper. It's very deep meaning it has. Like,
it's supposed to be deep meaning.
Yeah.
One is Vaishnava philosophy. And it is, we're getting near the end of the 10th canto. Mm. So it has to be deep.
Yeah.
It is foolish and artificial to think oneself equal to the Supreme Lord, and it is still more foolish to think one has not seen God. Everybody's seen God. It's just that we don't understand that whatever we're seeing is God. And the points of value within that, that's specifically where we can note God. Because we're not going to notice him in everything. But what we value, that's God. That's why it works. That's why we are attracted. That's why we value it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is seeing God according to his capacity. The only difference is that the theist sees God as the Supreme Personality, the most beloved Krishna, and the atheist sees the absolute truth as ultimate death. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, you have a coffin. Right? And one foot's in the coffin, right? And the other foot's on a banana peel, right? So God's that banana peel, right? So everyone's seen God, right? Because a devotee, see what's happening here is that they're starting to transform this from just the elements of the technical philosophy and the sadhana and the vaidhi into actually the spiritual perspective. Now, the basis of this, the essence of this, that's there all along. You can see even now the technical side of it. And so what he's showing here is there is no such thing as means the material consciousness is simply people who don't use it properly. You know, it's just like saying, is the prison separate from the country? It's part of the country. But it's the place where those who won't use the country properly, they go there. So the same way, but it's all one country. So it's all Krishna's energy. But this happens to be a place within it for those who won't use it properly. Then they're there and they have their own perspective. Like in the prison, they have their own culture. They have their own hierarchy. They have their own whole thing going on there. Right? Like that. So we have these things. We say, oh, this is so real. But that's not real. That the prison is its own separate place. There is no country. There is no one in control. It just happens, you know, somehow or another, just by chance. You know, just one day it showed up. You know, and everybody's made out of, you know, all the, you know, how you say, cement blocks that the prison's made out of, it transformed into the prisoners. You know, it's all illusion. No, you've come from outside. So you go back to Godhead. You didn't come from the prison. You came from outside the prison. Right? Unless you're in Panama and your family's there with you and you happen to be born there, because they can come and go. Just the father has to stay, right? The family can come and go. Like that. That's a different thing. But, right? So, we're from the spiritual world. Then, because we're not dealing with the energy properly, we're transferred here, right? You're born as a free citizen and then you be misbehaved, then you're put in the prison. You don't start in the prison. Right? So that's the whole point, is when you see in that proper perspective, like how does a citizen of the state see it? There's the state, and then within that there's prisons for people who make trouble. So they see it as all one administration. Right? Maybe different departments, but it's one administration. So that's what's coming out here, is the perspective of those from the spiritual world is being brought out. Gradually, we see with Prahlad Maharaj, then he's starting to emphasize that. And then as we're going, it's getting more and more. And then here, now at the end of the 10th canto, we've seen how they act. Now we're seeing the philosophy from that perspective. Like before 10th canto, we're seeing it from our conditioned state and trying to elevate it. But now, after 10th canto, now they're showing it from the perspective of those from the transcendental platform. Not that the others isn't also being from the transcendental platform, but the wording, the examples in that make it such that we, in our conditioning, will relate from our position, like it said. It's just that somebody uses everything in Krishna's service, then, as Prabhupada was saying, they use the material body and all that, mm-hmm. then it's good.
The activities are never forms. Last page, second paragraph, third one.
Yeah, okay, yeah, it was where I hear. Right? So they're engaging it. But they think it's my body and it's the material world. So as long as you think it's your body and material world, then you look at it from that perspective. But once you start to get purified, then you can look at it from the actual perspective. Like the prisoner thinks I'm a prisoner, but I follow the rules and all that, then that's progressive. But at some point he understands, I'm a member of the state, and there's laws. And so if I follow that, that's how I'm a proper member of the state. You understand? So it's a natural progression. So we're seeing, we're starting to see this other side. And this is just the transcendental, you know, view of it, the realization of it.
But unfortunately, we are Tatastha Shakti.
Unfortunately, we're Tatastha Shakti. Why is that unfortunate?
Because the tendency of being Tatastha will also be there when we return.
The tendency to be attractive when we return will also be there. Where does it say that? Can you give some praman?
This is it.
Because I mean, all the evidence I've ever heard, Krishna says once going there, one never returns.
Okay.
Very good.
She said.
That was evidence. Okay. Okay. When properly utilized, neither the superior nor inferior energies emanating from the Supreme Personality of Godhead are false. It is... did he do that? Yeah, ultimate death. Because a devotee understands the all-pervasive feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is the most practical philanthropist and altruist. Such an intelligent person therefore gives up all stereotyped ideas and joins the Krishna conscious movement for factual liberation. Because these others are stereotyped. Oh, we're Westerners, we're this, we're that. But it says that someone gives them up and then joins Krishna consciousness. Not joins Krishna consciousness and then cultivates stereotyped ideas. It doesn't say that. You already have your stereotype. You leave them at the door. It's like when you come into the house, you leave the shoes at the door. Yeah. And joins the Krishna consciousness movement for factual liberation. Right? Because that's the whole thing. Means you hear when Gopakumar went to the spiritual world, right? And he was there at the gate and he saw all these different personalities coming and going and all those things, you know, people in Shantaras and Dasyaras and all that, you know, the different forms and shapes and all that. And he was identifying the different classes and all the different kinds of groups of devotees and all that. Where did he mention Americans? No?
Maybe he couldn't identify them.
Maybe he couldn't. Yeah, maybe he didn't have the true spiritual vision.
You know, frame of reference.
Yeah. Yeah, you understand. So that's the whole point, is this: these things aren't there. That's why it says we're not American, we're not Russian, we're not English, we're not Indian, we're not any of these things. We're not. So to bring up, oh, we're Americans, we're not Indians. But what has that got to do with anything?
God.
You know, what has that got to do with it? You know, it's like, you know, the bus stops and, you know, it's time to get out of the bus. We're at the end of the line. No, and you have some reason that doesn't have to do, but I like this seat. What has that got to do with it? I always sit in this seat. Yeah, so the bus is at the end of the line. Get off. You know, it's just coming up with these things that has no meaning. So that's the whole point, is that such an intelligent person therefore gives up stereotyped ideas and joins the Krishna conscious movement for factual liberation. So Krishna conscious movement, that is universal. Only he can understand the Lord fully through the Vedic sound. Because it's not just hearing the sound and then using your intelligence. You can't know the Lord. You can only know the Lord if he reveals himself. Right? And as you keep material attachments, then he doesn't reveal himself in that area. You know, he'll show you how to get purified so you can move beyond. But, yeah.
This all-pervasive teacher, that means Brahman, indicate.
Yeah. Well, he's all-pervasive means, as Brahman is all-pervasive, Paramatma is also all-pervasive. Right. So if you understand this, then where is this regional element? It doesn't exist. It's all Krishna. Now, because it's Krishna, and it's Krishna's nature, it's his energies, it has all unique features. But it has unique features because it's Krishna's place. Does that make sense? You know. So that's the point. It's not like that because of this thing, because people were in those places before that and they did something very different. You know what I'm saying? You don't understand. You have this place. I think they call it, what do they call it? The Fertile Crescent. You heard of it? The cradle of civilization. No? Nobody? What? You can't hear. The Fertile Crescent?
Egypt?
A little more east. Between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Right? That area there. That's where the Sumerians used to live, you know, 5,000 years ago or so. Right? But then in the same place, I think, along came the Babylonians, I think. And they took over the place. But they liked what they were doing there, so they kept the same basic customs and everything like that, and lifestyle and all that, but now it's Babylonians. Then, with some time, then, you know, hundreds of years, then the Assyrians come along and take over. Now it's the Assyrian culture. Same place. They also thought these guys were doing some far-out stuff, so they kept all the stuff like that. Right? And then at one point, later than that, then the Persians come along, and they take over everything. And now it's the Persian place. Right? Does that make sense? And then the Romans come along, they take over. And then the thing splits, and then you have the East Empire and the West Empire. And then the East Empire somehow or another becomes the Ottoman Empire. But it's the same piece of land. It hasn't changed. You know? And then at one point, then it's Saddam Hussein. Or insane, whatever, however you like to pronounce it, if you want to, you know. Does that make sense? So, it's all, so, what's the meaning of it? So it's Krishna's energy. It still acts in the same way. The water there still flows from this way to that way. It's still wet. You know? Does that make sense? So it acts as Krishna's energy. And that nature of it is all pervading. That's why wherever you are, you deal, you get the same thing. Like here. You stick your hand in the hand pump. What happens? Does your hand stay dry or get wet? Okay. Now let's say we go over to Bombay, right? Okay, and you stick your hand in the water there. Then what happens?
Wet with salt.
Yeah, wet with salt, also sewage, you know, all kinds of stuff. Like that. You understand? So you go to the Maldives, it'll be the same. You go over to the Middle East, it'll be the same. You go to the, you know, Africa, you know, the Cape of the Horn of Africa, it'll be the same. You know, you go over to Louisiana, it'll be the same. Just you get a little music while you're sticking your hand in the water. Right? You go out to the West Coast, and then just watch out for the surfboards when you stick your hand in the water. You understand? It's the same thing. Why? Because it's Krishna's creation. Right? And the Ganga, when it's, the, you know, Mandakini on the heavenly planets, still wet. When she's the Bhagavati on the lower planet, still wet. You understand? It's just, that's how Krishna's created water. So it's all pervading. So if you understand the Brahman, there's nothing that's not Krishna, and there's nothing that doesn't function according to Krishna's rules. So therefore, there, you can engage it all in Krishna's service. Right? Does that make sense? That's the whole point. And then, what you engage, because there's unlimited, so you can't engage everything, you engage those things that connect to you according to your duties. Does that make sense? Yeah, so like that. All good? All good? Yeah. Okay.
So Maharaj, this chapter was can say crucial, understand.
Very?
Very important.
Very important, because you see, he said that after Narad Muni went, after he heard this, then he went to Vyasadeva's ashram. So you see, that's why it's here. So this is the essence of the Vedic literature. Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence of the Vedic, the mature fruit of the Vedic literature. So it means it's this knowledge then expanded and given, you know, examples and put into the Puranic form so that we can appreciate it. Right? But that's the knowledge that's being explained. There's not more knowledge than that. You could have detail. Like it says, you create everything, this, that, so you can have a place where it's describing the creation. But it's not that there's some points that don't come up there. It's like Gita. Everything's in Gita. There may be further details somewhere else. But it's all there. So these points where it's the essence, that it means that. Okay. So, yes. So it's very important. So you can see is that it goes from the basic understanding up to this highest understanding, but it's going through that quickly because they have that realization due to their devotion. So that's the point. They have the devotion, they can understand like this and see like this. Chapter 88. Lord Shiva saved from Vrikasura. Pratigya. One can approach the transcendental region only by worshipping Lord Krishna, not Shiva or Brahma or any other demigod. Sure. hospital. Okay. Chapter 88 summarizes questions and answers. Maharaj Pariket asked Srila Sukadev Goswami question 1044 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Question 1044. From 1088 1 and 2. King Pariket said, "Those demigods, demons, and humans who worship Lord Shiva, a strict renunciate, usually enjoy wealth and sense gratification, while the while the worshippers of the Supreme Lord Hari, the husband of the goddess of fortune, do not." What's going on here? "We wish to properly understand this matter, which greatly puzzles us. Indeed, the results attained by the worshippers of these two lords of opposite characters are contrary to what one would expect." Srila Sukadev Goswami answers this question in the rest of this chapter by narrating a story. Yes, because the point comes back to is this: you can only take to the transcendental region by Krishna's grace. So therefore, if you're too materially absorbed, how you'll get to the spiritual world? Well, Lord Shiva can't give you that liberation. He can only give you benediction to stay in the material world. Therefore, what do you use to stay in the material world? Material facility.
But it is a little strange after the discussion of the other chapter, it is a story about the topic.
Yes, but no, but still is the point is remember as Boris, by Krishna's mercy is his greatest quality. So then we see here it's only by Krishna's mercy. Krishna only can give you that transcendental position, that realization, because from the last chapter then we are appreciating what's there. But it's also not that they don't go back and forth. Having come to that, there was a question from something before. Like you see, we're going on with one of the manus and all that. Then they'll go back and ask, well, what about this thing? Then they'll start from there and go forward again. That's why many times historians have a problem. Because for them, history has to be in an exact, by date, chronological order. But the Vedic chronology is by understanding. It's like the difference between the Vedic and, well, let's say modern theater and the Vedic. Modern, they're always trying to establish, you know, the realness of the illusion. Everyone knows it's an illusion, but you try to make it establish its reality. And that's very important. Otherwise, you say, how can that happen? Because it's all about how well they acted out the external form, the gross form. While we see we go back in time, the Greeks to some degree, but then the Vedic specifically, the Sanskrit theater, then it's about the moods, how they transform and move. So you're trying to establish on the mood of that, how that mood moves and transforms. That's what you're trying to get. So it doesn't matter about the external. You don't worry about that. You know, so it's like a Fellini movie that's not so weird. Right? Just things transform and it doesn't matter because it's the mood. Mm-hmm. It means Lord Chaitanya, like I explained, they're all on the stage. Lord Chaitanya's there, the pastimes, then they're performing a drama. You know, they just put it together and do a drama of Krishna and his pastimes. So they're doing the Dhanakeli or no? The Kusum Sarovar, like that, about the flowers and fighting over the flowers, and who Vrindavan belongs to Krishna, and then they say, no, it belongs to Vrinda, and he says, no, but I'm married to Vrinda, so he belongs to me, and you know, it's like, and they're all, Vrinda, you married this guy? And you know, all that kind of jazz. So they're going through that, and they come to the point of a particular, intensity of the ecstasy of the absorption, and that's what they're trying to obtain. So then they just start doing kirtan. You know, they don't finish it up and go, wow, that was a great drama. Yeah, sure it was, and all that. We should do that again, you know. Yeah, you know, like that. But, like they would in West modern theater. They just change the mood. Right there, they just start doing kirtan. But it's not like them as they are there. And you're thinking, wow, this is nice. And then because they have two entrances right at the back of the stage, they all are doing kirtan, go out one entrance, and when they come back to the other, then people are coming in, falling on the ground, they're crying and everything, because Lord Chaitanya's taken sannyas. So you don't have to put the thing in how he went and did this and that. It's just that's the next aspect of the taste in Krishna's lila that they want to bring out. So just, and how clever that is. That's way more clever than modern theater. You know, just going in and that without you know, they don't have to do a set change, nothing. It's just like that is simultaneous, just from this ecstasy into this other thing like that, just what the how the moods go. You know what I'm saying? And then you find out, and then somebody's talking about this and that, and then the barber comes out, he's freaking out, and the whole, you know, like that. Does that make sense? So that's how it works. It's about the flow of the mood. The essential mood of like that, Krishna Lord Chaitanya takes the thing is the separation of the devotees, right? That's the main thing. So that's what comes out, and Krishna Lord Chaitanya and his associates, and not only in that ecstasy of their remembering Krishna and Sankirtan and all that, and then it transforms into the other one. So when they're with Lord Chaitanya, then it's this, and when he goes away, then it's that. So it's perfectly flowing. It's perfectly logical. But it's a different style. So in here, it's about how the understanding goes. So therefore, it is chronological. But the problem is, this chronology is given just time. But this is the chronology of how the conversation went and the understanding went. But they'll go, no, but in time it didn't happen like this. But the conversation, it did happen like this. So it's just they have a definition of what time is, how they want to apply it, and won't accept other definitions. Hence, we call it seriatim. Because if we say chronology, then the academics, they cringe. Because, oh, it's not chronological. And all this. Yeah. So, Narad Muni, Vedavyas, Narayan Rishi, they saved us from this mundane perspective. Right? So it's just, now this is how the question goes. So it goes back to something else. Because if you try to do everything at once, you get too many facts, you don't get the flow. That's why modern history is so boring. So only when they take like one person and then show how it goes through like that, then you get an interest in the history. But they'll show him up to here, and then this guy here, and then that guy there, and then this one over here, and then that guy did over here, and then listen, and you can't get anything. Right? So the way is you just take that one, you take it through, and then if you need, you either go on, or you go back, if there's, like say there's two things happening that are important. Then you go back, catch the other one, and then go. But if there's not, then you see sometimes the kings, it just goes from one to the next, and there is no overlap. And then sometimes it'll go back, and then like that. You know, it's just like you go to Hiranyakashipu and then go back to Prahlad and then go through that. And then, does that make sense? So it's a different literary style. But it's just too esoteric for the modern academics to appreciate. That's all. It's just sad. Because it's not that they don't have intellectual capacity. It's just that they've defined things in a certain way. They can't see it differently. Just like I remember, then, you know, growing up with math, you learn math in a particular way. And you're always exposed to it in a particular way. So then, one time I came across the Vedic math. And there's a book on Vedic math. And I was reading it, and it was just so excellent. But I could not understand how it worked. Though I'd done well in math and things like that, I couldn't understand it. But the concepts it was talking about were fabulous. But the actual mechanics, I could not see how the numbers could work that way, because I've been conditioned, they work in a very specific way. And so then, it wasn't until Kurma Chaitanya came, because he had been a math major, and in that, they had taught alternative math systems. They didn't teach Vedic math. They just taught alternative math. Because the mathematicians that are really into it, they come up with all kinds of far-out stuff that they play for fun. So he had, you know, probably something, a semester or something of all this alternative stuff. So then he recognized it's alternative. And then he could catch it. And then once it's shown, it is so simple. It's way more simple than modern math. But because it's so conditioned, I could not see it in the other way. So that's what we're saying, is that not that they don't have brains that they couldn't see it, it's just they're so conditioned by one way of doing it, and if they don't do it that way, they're so worried about losing their status in the academy. So therefore, even if they could, they won't. Because it's their identity. But that's the advantage. Vaishnavas aren't worried about this kind of identity, so then they can do whatever. They're independent. Right? The intellectuals think we're independent. No, they're not. You're totally controlled by the academy. Right? You have to do it in a certain way. Well, here is that it's not that we could do it whatever we like, but we follow in the footsteps of the acharyas who are optas, who are well situated. Transcendentally situated. We're not following after great acharyas who are totally conditioned. Like that. Yeah. You know, so the concept of parampara, these concepts are there, but they're not in their natural state. They're in the material state. And so it takes on the flavor of distinction, adoration, and profit, and all these kind of things. And that's why it's hard to recognize the Vedic Academy as so far superior, because all the scholars don't identify as scholars and don't have an attitude. So then you just think it's ordinary. Because their attitude is more humble than even an ordinary person. So it's just taken, oh, what's the big deal? But the esoteric level of it, the fineness of it, the depth of it is way, way greater. And Prabhupada is so expert, he's explained these things in simple, simple words. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, no, he used, more exact words. And therefore, per page of his book, you need to look in the dictionary 5 times. Sometimes more, yeah. Well, I was thinking, last time I checked like that, that would have been back in the... Yeah, that would have been... Yes, sorry to say, late 70s, early 80s. That's when I sat down with the dictionary and just tried to figure it out, It was 5 per page, average. Yeah, now they don't use all that language as much, so then it may be more, 8, 10. But they do have, coming from Latin and Greek, some more exact words that, theologians and that will use and all that. And some academics know, you could use those. But Prabhupada has so nicely made it accessible for us by using language we can understand and making it very, very accessible. But because it doesn't carry that intellectual flavor, people don't think it's academic. That's why we study this in context of the acharyas who will put the technical academic kind of things. And you see Prabhupada saying exactly the same thing. Right? And when we say it gets really technical here, the main purport's of Prabhupada's from the Krishna book. And you see the points he's saying are so esoteric that we won't catch them. We just know that somehow or another chapter 87 is that one that you kind of start going and you just wonder, is it over yet? Yeah, 5th canto, 2nd canto, and what is it? Is it the one about autumn?
Description of autumn.
That's another one that generally kind of.
Prabhupada wrote that when he first sent a message to Japan.
Yes.
Yes.
Very nice. So that's what I mean, like preaching. So it's, you take something that they can relate to, but you give full philosophy. The idea is that you take something that they'll do in no philosophy, that's called no preaching, not soft preaching. Right here. Yes. So.
Well, pro-modern devotees, they have the argument is that we're using our system and we attain catharsis. And you using the Vedic system, you attain Bhav. So it's basically the same thing. So
since when is catharsis and Bhav the same?
That they put it on the same level.
Yeah, that's like saying having a nice dinner and throwing out the garbage are on the same level.
They're very connected.
They are connected. What's not part of the nice dinner, that's the garbage. Yeah. So you want to get rid of. So in other words, liberating yourself, that's one thing. But developing prema, That's separate. Just like chanting in Nama Bas, you'll get liberation, but you'll never get prema. But Shuddha Nam, that will give you prema. Right? But Shuddha Nam will also clear all the anarthas. So the whole point is that the Vedic system already includes what the modern system does and more. So why would you be attached to a system that's less efficient? That's the point. It's not that they're equal. That's the whole point. They try to take it, well, India is a country and, you know, the West is, you know, a country, and so therefore, as country, they're equal. But since, who said they're equal? The one that's the burnt remnants of the Vedic culture, then that, how is that in any way equal to something that is the burnt remnants of a bunch of barbarians? Even, you know, it was probably, you could probably get further and talk with one of those, you know, 1100, you know, AD barbarians, and they'd probably understand our philosophy more than their descendants. You know? So how is it, how are they the same? Now, if it's your area and you want to, that's how you maintain yourself, you have a job there, you work at the university, fine. What's the big deal? If you can do something, you know, within the system and preach, then fine. And if not, you open a club. Because generally the campus won't let you teach whatever you like. So you have to teach their curriculum. But you can, you know, have a club and do that and preach and so many things like that. But as an academic, you can't. So this thing is that it's the same. Though as an academic, you cannot say conclusions. But we can say conclusions all day. So how is non-conclusions going to get you liberated? I don't see how they're the same. It's just false ego. Now, as a job, if they go there, they pay them, and that's how they maintain their family so they can be Krishna conscious, then great. But to say that they're actually changing the academy and this and that is like, that's a serious misrepresentation of reality. What can they change? You know, and who's working that hard? I know one devotee worked in Colombia. He used to be here. He used to do our Sanskrit. His name's Advaita. I'm not sure what his karmic name is, but you might know him by. And so then he was working even at that time on the Aryan invasion, how it's bogus. The Aryan invasion is still kind of taught. There's little cracks in it. There's some doubts, but he's been working in the academic field since that time in the 80s. So it's like 35 years. And, you know, he's starting in his place getting some inroads into this. But he's the only one I've heard of that actually tries to adjust something. But it's just then they'll accept that they come from somewhere else. But are they going to accept that, no, it came from the Vedic culture, it's the original culture, and Sanskrit's the original language and all that? In the 1800s, the German scholars accepted that. In fact, when I went to school, when we had a history of language, the first thing the guy told us was all languages come from Sanskrit. He never mentioned it again. He only talked about Greek and Latin for the whole term. So it was known. So is it progressing or is it regressing? So now they don't know that. They don't say that. So you have to know what the academy is and know what you can do with it. If by nature you're an academic, that's how you make your money, great. What does it matter? You do that, you work at the post office, you're in IT, you deliver pizza. What does it matter? As long as you're a devotee. But to try to elevate it to some special position that they're doing something so fabulous is kind of like, since when? You know what I'm saying? If they say, no, but so many scholars, that's because you're preaching to them as devotees, not as scholars. And if they say, no, because we're scholars, they're accepting us, I don't think so. Because those scholars talk about... Did you ever see that one thing that they did, I think it was 50 years since Prabhupada came? I can't remember if it was on Harvard campus or Yale or Princeton or something like that. He came and gave a lecture there. And they arranged a thing where all the devotees and all those professors and that were there or had come at that time, they all came together. And you know what was really far out? There's one of them, I can't remember which one he is. It's one of the ones that, you know, ends up in our books, giving, you know, the little something from him like that. One of those. What he's talking is you're from the West, you know, from the Eastern culture. You know, you have your own tradition. Why don't you present that? Why don't you give that to the West? And he's saying, he said, I said that then. He's always told it, and he was at that time saying it. I think it happened last year. Right? And he's saying, represent the culture that you represent. Why are you trying to, you know, blend it into the Western thing? That's his thing. Well, why are you doing that? Who's into you? It means people already have the West and they're tired of it. They want something different. You have an alternative. Show the alternative. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, and the devotees are there trying to, you know, not step on any toes and do all that kind of. So the whole point is this is the culture. This is what we do. Who can complain? You do it different? Yeah. We don't care. We do it different. That's what we do. We do it the way we like. You know? You know what I'm saying? When you eat pizza, do you put ketchup on it? No. But, you know, basically, 2 million or 4 million people here do.
Really?
Yes. You've never seen? They always have ketchup there. They have to eat it with ketchup. It's just, you can't not eat it with ketchup. Yeah. Huh? Yes, the most of the cash, everything with cash. Lick your fingers, put on it. Tasty fingers.
If it is remaining, everyone does that also.
Yeah, yeah, then you lick it up. Right? The crust may be there, but you'll eat the catch up. Right? So the whole point is that intellectuals who are cultured, they accept that there's different covenant, and you're committed to that and you're doing that, then it's great. They won't do it, but they're comfortable that you do it. And so then you explain what you're doing to, as a person. So in other words, the preaching done to this person is done as a person, not as an academic. That's the point. You can't preach to an academic. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. It's illegal in the academy. Right? But them as a person, they can have whatever they belief they have. As long as they teach the curriculum, they don't care what your belief is. You know? Does that make sense? You know, so that's the whole thing. So this whole idea is that, no, this is just another way. Jato mat tato pat. I don't buy it. It's not. Does that make sense? And Prabhupada says, you know, it has to be adjusted. They call it a slaughterhouse. Just it may be they're older and it's more mature, you know, and it may be instead of just going out in the back and just, you know, hitting him with a brick or something, now they're following rabbinical law or something, you know, and so therefore it's so much more sophisticated. But the point is you end up dead. Is that make sense? So that's the whole point, is that they're not the same. That's the point. That's why we're studying Vedanta Sutra, so you can tell the fine differences. Because where's the pure devotion? No, it's about being nice and being accepted. That's great. That's called public relations. Right? Which is an aspect of preaching. Preaching is actually telling them the philosophy. But public relations, it's etiquette. It's like that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to behave nice. You're supposed to be cultured. And if that's the area and people you can work with, that's the circle you move in. And you take them as far as you can. But more than that, you can't go. Does that make sense? So it has to be understood what the limit is. So you're dealing with a limited, utensil, and can't claim that it's the same as something else that's superior. Now, it's not that we're superior, it's just the Vedic system is superior. The great Acharya is a superior. So we're just following them and doing our best. We may not do a great job. They may be doing a better job at following the modern academy than we are at the Vedic. But the point is the effect of the two are night and day. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Because what knowledge is there? What do they know? What's the soul? What's the material energy? What's God? What's the process to elevate? What's the ultimate goal? Not one of those five questions can any academic from the academic field answer. There is nobody. There is no discipline that can answer this question. So what knowledge they have. Now, going on and talking and this and having opinions and that, they're so good, so intelligent. I mean, they're super intelligent people. But it doesn't mean that because you're super intelligent, you can't be misguided when it comes to the philosophy or spiritual life. But when it comes to knowing their Egyptology or something, they're quite good. They know so many details. But still, they wouldn't know certain things that we know. I remember seeing something the other day. They had dug up somewhere, and they're looking at it, and the shape of it, wow, what's this? Is this? And they're coming, and I'm looking at it and go, you know, I was just thinking, you know, that's what you roll chapatis on. You know, saying so rolling in that is just that you're, and they're trying to, what does this do? You know, they use this, or, you know, I guess. It's like, so they do have limitations. You know, just regular stuff that we use here that are there in, you know, it's called, what's that, Mahendradaro? Yeah, it's the same culture. So they have all the same stuff that we have.
Yes.
Like that. And so it's just that they don't know what it is because, you know, it's you know, yeah. So it's, yeah. Yes, no? Okay. Yes.
Regarding the chronology, we see from the last five, six chapters, Krishna and Dwarkavasi going to Kurukshetra. From that time onwards, Krishna supremacy is established by the devotees, by the sages,
yes.
And prayers of personified Vedas. Now after this chapter also, like Lord Shiva, then Bhrigumuni is coming to bring the test.
Oh, test, okay, that'll be in this chapter.
Next chapter.
Oh, next chapter, okay, to establish Krishna supremacy.
Here Lord Shiva discussed, then Brahma and Shiva and Vishnu.
Okay.
There Vishnu supremacy is.
Okay. So we're establishing Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam.
Yes.
So that's me. So that's what the chronology is doing, is establishing that.
Yes.
So you have to try from here, there, you have to catch so many things till it works it out, and then you have it.
Yes.
You know, it's like cooking a very, you know, sophisticated recipe. You start with one thing, and then you finish that, and then you start all over again with something else, and then you start with something else, and then you start putting it together, and everything like that. Yes? No?
Yes.
Okay. Jaya Prakashika. The 88th chapter explains that Vishnu is worthy of service and is beyond the material modes, whereas Shiva is touched by the modes. Shiva is put into danger by his own devotee, Vrikasura. Vishnu and his devotee, both beyond the modes, are always exchanging bliss, whereas Shiva and his devotee, caught up in the modes, experience suffering. The personified Vedas already stated that amongst the forms of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, Bhagavan and his devotee are the best. Now in a chapter and a half amongst Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, Vishnu is pointed out as the most worthy of service. Sardartha Darshini 10.88.1. Right? So that's the... Then this chapter describes how it is that the devotees of Vishnu attain liberation, while the devotees of other deities obtain material opulences. So liberation is higher than karma. So it looks like, oh, they're getting everything, the devotees are getting nothing. No, they're getting liberation, which is the higher result, while the devotees of the demigods, they're just getting, you know, the results of karma. While the devotees are getting results of jnana and beyond. Right? Yeah. Lord Vishnu possesses all opulences, while Lord Shiva lives in poverty. Yet the devotees of Vishnu are generally poverty-stricken, while Shiva's attain abundant wealth. When Maharaj Parikit asked Sukadeva Goswami to explain this puzzling fact, the sage replied as follows. Lord Shiva manifests as false ego in three varieties, according to the three modes of nature. From this false ego arise the five physical elements and the other transformations of material nature, totaling 16. When a devotee of Lord Shiva worships his manifestation in any of these elements, the devotee obtains all sorts of corresponding enjoyable opulences. But because Lord Sri Hari is transcendental to the modes of material nature, his devotees also become transcendental. Right? So they worship him through the modes of nature, through some particular material elements. By that, they get the results of that material element. But that means they stay here. Well, then, the devotees, they worship Krishna, who's beyond the modes, in processes beyond the modes, and they become transcendental. So that's the...
By association.
Yes.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Prabhupada ki.